You just finished speaking to a class. Did you teach, or was it on one topic?
No, it was sort of a combination of topics. The students had questions about the utility of coercive interrogations of Al-Qaeda detainees, some discussion of drone strikes in Pakistan, discussion of the events of the Arab Spring and the extent to which the region has benefited or not, Iran, Israel, other questions like that.
You're going to give the Keenan Lecture. Talk a little bit about what you plan to speak about tonight.
Well, the title of the lecture is about it's how ordinary Muslims, President Obama, are remaking the Middle East. And so it'll be a discussion of U.S. policy in the Middle East, the extent to which the Arab Spring has benefited the people of the Middle East or not, a little bit of discussion of Al-Qaeda and its role in sort of the post-Arab Spring Muslim world.
Now, despite the fact that Osama bin Laden is no longer alive, his name and legacy are still very much with us. You were there when he announced to the world that he was at war with the United States. Walk us through a little bit of that experience and how it might have shaped how you viewed what came after 9/11, the manhunt, and ultimately his death.
Well, in 97, I was the producer for CNN of what was bin Laden's first television interview, and he declared war on the West. You know, he declared war on the United States and its allies during the course of that interview, and you know, at the time he hadn't really done anything, and he seemed serious and well-informed, and people around him seemed serious. It was hard to tell what he had in mind. He ended the interview by saying, when asked about his future plans, he said, you'll hear about them and read about them in the media, God willing. And of course, then he bombed two U.S. embassies in Africa in 98. He did 9/11. And, you know, I spent a lot of time researching and thinking about this guy. So on 9/11, when the second plane hit the tower, I knew it was bin Laden. Very few people had the capability and the intent to attack the United States. Some people might have the intent, but not the capability. And some people might have the capability, but not the intent. Al-Qaeda was the only group that had both.
Were you surprised, I guess, with how long he was able to evade capture?
You know, I've recently written a book about the hunt for bin Laden called Manhunt, and I looked at some other manhunts. Some of the CIA looked at other manhunts when they were coming up empty on finding bin Laden. They started looking at how and why did the Nazis find Eichmann after the Holocaust. That took 15 years. You know, people who are fairly smart, who are not making obvious mistakes, can sort of fly beneath the radar for a long time. Bin Laden, of course, was a subject of a very intensive manhunt for many years, but he was not communicating on the internet or cell phone or satellite phone, which made, you know, the United States is very reliant on signals intelligence, and we have great capacity to track people's emails and phone calls. So if you just go off the grid, it's a lot harder for you to be found. But bin Laden was found eventually because he was communicating through a courier network, and it became clear that if you could find his couriers, you could find him.
And bin Laden has certainly been back in the news recently with the release of Zero Dark Thirty. What is your general feeling about that film, I guess? And there are the criticisms that it's not as accurate as it could have been.
Well, you know, it's 2.5 hours, and it's trying to encompass 10 years in 2.5 hours. So, they had to make shortcuts and sort of concertina and particular characters. I think people will walk away with the feeling that coercive interrogations of Al-Qaeda detainees were useful in finding bin Laden. That, I think, is probably not true, although much of this information remains classified. So it's hard to make a fully accurate determination until the Senate Intelligence Committee, which has been investigating this question for years, will hopefully release its report in the next few months. And then we can really find out to what extent were coercive interrogations useful in terms of producing information about Al-Qaeda, and in particular about finding bin Laden.
Talk a little bit about the effect of drones, which seem to be the wave of the future, the effect that has on the landscape of this fight against terrorism, and do you feel that it's an effective tool?
Well, I mean, bin Laden himself, we know from the documents that have been recovered and published that were found in his Abbottabad compound, he was very concerned about the effect that drones were having on Al-Qaeda. So certainly they, in terms of killing the top leadership in Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and also to some degree in Yemen, they've been quite useful. But are they a tool that the United States can overuse? Sure, because, most of the victims of these strikes are not leaders of al-Qaeda, they're lower-level militants in the Taliban. And in 2010, the United States did 122 drone strikes in Pakistan. The numbers get gone down, but yeah, it's common sense would suggest that 122 drone strikes in a year is overkill. And if the price of a drone program like that is that we anger 180 million Pakistanis, which is the price we're paying, I think that's a high price to pay. So you have to balance. When you've got a leader of al-Qaeda, you can't capture, you know, a drone strike seems completely reasonable. On the other hand, you know, just whenever lower-level militants come into the frame, we should sort of think twice, I think, before we just take a shot.
And this is a big question, but where does al-Qaeda stand today, in your estimation?
I think they're in terrible shape, you know. They haven't done an attack on the United States since 9/11. They haven't done a successful attack in the West since the July 7, 2005 attacks in London on the transportation system. They, in country after country around the world, and most recently in Mali, an al-Qaeda affiliate was basically given the boot by the French army. People don't really want to be ruled by al-Qaeda or groups like it because they tend to impose Taliban-style rule on the population. They ban singing, they ban dancing, they execute people for minor infringements like smoking. And that's not a sort of utopia for most Muslims. And so I think that around the Muslim world, there's kind of been a rejection of al-Qaeda and its ideas. There will always be some takers. And we saw with the attack in Benghazi in September that there are groups like that that exist in Libya. But the interesting thing about that attack was the day after, or shortly after it happened, a mob of people living in Benghazi went and burned down the building in which this group was housed. So there is quite a lot of, yeah. When bin Laden died, there was not a huge upswelling of protests in the Muslim world because he didn't, his ideas and his group were providing absolutely no answers to the real problems of the Muslim world, which are, you know, very much economic in much of the Arab world and also political. And al-Qaeda didn't have any answers for those.
What would you like students or anybody who comes to hear your speech tonight to really take away from it?
Well, I think that, you know, terrorism doesn't work if we're not terrorized. And, you know, if we turn al-Qaeda into a 10-foot bogeyman, it will be the, you know, in a way it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you actually have a much more rational response to this group, which hasn't done anything of any merit against the United States for a long time domestically and is losing popularity very dramatically in the Muslim world and is on the wrong side of history. I think that, you know, hopefully I can sort of give people the message that, you know, al-Qaeda and its affiliates are, they're not in good shape.
I want to thank you so much for your time. That's Peter Bergen, journalist and author, speaking at Transylvania University.